Hello and welcome to the 100 podcast. It's Ed here with you. Hope you're well. Today, joined by Jack Fox to talk all things 100. Jack, how are you doing, mate?
I'm good, thanks. Thanks for having me back. I've been quite enjoying the tournament so far. I'm looking to get into it, really.
I think it's been a good tournament so far. I've enjoyed a lot of it. I think it would have been nice to see maybe a few more close finishes. But in general, there's been some fantastic innings. I mean, Will Jack, Smead, Adam Lyth. There's been loads of fun. So even though there haven't maybe been the loads of close finishes we'd like, I think the quality of cricket's been pretty great.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, the close finishes thing, it's hard because in any tournament, you could just kind of, you're rolling the dice every time. I mean, you can get a lot of, it doesn't really say an awful lot, because sometimes you just get a lot, you get lucky with a lot of good finishes, sometimes you don't. And I think a lot of the time, kind of like you suggested, the games that weren't at all close were often because of a high amount of quality from one player on one side rather than just an absolute capitulation from the losing team.
Yeah, I think that's pretty fair. And in general, I've loved watching it. And there's been some great breakout seasons from a lot of players. And as we get into the back end of this tournament, there's going to be a lot of those individual performances which are really going to be under the spotlight. And that's kind of why I wanted to do this episode with you, mate. What we're going to do is the key players for every single team going forward. We're going to pick out a player that's going to be absolutely crucial to this team down the stretch as they try and break into that top three. At this point, there's probably six teams still in contention. And for the top six, Brave just on the outside, Welsh Fire absolutely on the outside, but we'll run through every team anyway and look at those key players. And we'll start at the top of the table with the Trent Rockets, who have been really, really good this year. I don't think we had the highest expectations, but any Andy Flower side is going to be well coached. They're going to have a game plan. And I think the game plan is going pretty much as well as it could do at the moment. They've played six, won five. They look like they might already be into that top three. Darwin Milan, Alex Hales, all impressing. Lots of good stuff. What's impressed you about the Rockets so far, Jack?
I think, really, it's been just their balance. I mean, there seems to be any team that seemed, well, one of any teams that are excelling with sort of bat and ball. I mean, obviously, like you said, Milan and Hales have been going absolutely mad at the top of the order, winning games by themselves. But then you look down at their bowling, it's been pretty good and perhaps better than I expected. Everyone's chipping and taking wickets. So even though they're conceding runs through some of their bowlers, I just like the fact that they're going out with the bat, scoring runs quickly, and then they're taking wickets with the ball. It seems to be a much more positive brand of cricket than I thought they'd play, and certainly a lot positive than last year, which was a bit dire at times.
Yeah, I think that's the thing, isn't it? We talked about this pre-tournament. It's all about intent for them. Last year, it was very dour, was short at the top. Milan was very neutered. This year, Milan's been one of the quickest starters in T20 cricket, which has been a huge change. Alex Hales has been going at it as well, much more aggressive than he was last year. Hasn't really come off for him hugely yet, but he's been batting nicely. Darwin Milan's been the one who's been taking away games, averaging 60, striker over 185. But that's the great thing about them. Colin Munro has played really nicely. Hales has had a decent tournament. Daniel Sams has hit well at the back end as well. There's lots of players informing the batting lineup. And I think the fact that they suddenly bat down to nine with your choice of Rashid Khan, Daniel Sam, Samet Patel, all batting 7, 8, 9, just means you can go harder at the top. And I think that's really freed them up. Ultimately, I think that the issue coming into this season for them was the bowling, really. We didn't quite know if it would work. Marshall Dalanga came in poor form. We knew that Shamsi and Rashid Khan would be good. We knew Samet Patel would be good. But the seamers were really the issue, and that's why I think the key player for them down the stretch is someone who's hugely impressed me. Luke Wood, obviously played in six games, taken eight wickets, bowled some absolute gas at times. I think we knew Luke Wood was kind of one of those players under the radar quick. He's bowled seriously quick this tournament, bowled some insane Yorkers, been hooping the ball all around. He has been hugely and hugely impressive. And when you have two good spinners and your seam attacks maybe not quite the best in the tournament as the Rockets, you need someone to lead it. Luke would have stepped up.
Yeah, definitely. He's been really impressive. He seems to kind of have everything covered at the moment. Like you say, good pace, good Yorker. He can hit a hard length as well, but when the left arm angle obviously does help. I think he just seems very hard to keep out. He seems to be able to challenge the stumps from basically any length, I guess. I mean, he's not the tallest bowler. I think he kind of uses that to his advantage in that you see him bowling a hard length, you feel like could be, you know, isn't really drivable, but equally often it feels like it's also going to hit the stumps because it's not really bouncing hugely. So it's sort of that great area between you can't really pull it and you can't really drive it. And then it'll just slip in a 90-mile-an-hour bouncer or, like you say, a big in-dipping Yorker. And yeah, he's been in and around the England side a little bit, hasn't he? Or the squads a little bit. And I think he could be playing himself potentially towards that with all the injuries. But yeah, definitely last few games of this tournament, I think he's going to be huge. And if they're going to win, I think he needs to keep bowling pretty well.
I think he absolutely does. I think you're right. What he does do is challenge the stumps really nicely. That dismissal of Will Smead against the Birmingham Phoenix, where Will Smead tried to go and pull a ball which just didn't get up and knocked onto his leg stump. I think that's a really good example. He's kind of been this way through his career. He kind of had played a couple of games for Nottinghamshire before his big loan move to Worcestershire in 2018, where he bowled really well, but probably 4 or 5 miles an hour slower, even more so slower probably than what he's bowling now. And he was kind of the same back then. He swung it, he attacked the stumps. Now he's doing it considerably quicker with a gun Yorker that's kind of come out of nowhere, I think, really, given how some of the beauties he's bowled in this tournament have been phenomenal. The one to Miles Hammond and the one to Karan Pollard really stick out to me. And then the bumper as well, which again, this is skiddy, gets onto you really quickly, really hurries you up. So he's kind of been all around, also been pretty decent at the death. So he is going to be absolutely key for them, because ultimately the Trent Rockets coming to the tournament, it could maybe have been a weakness for them, this seam attack, but Luke Wood's leading it. The other player I want to mention, actually, a guy you're very big on, Sam Cook, who didn't play the initial games in this tournament, but since coming in for them has bowled very nicely. The ball's been moving around a lot with a new ball in the 100, actually, which is kind of an interesting point. But Sam Cook's been very good up top and then has bowled quite nicely throughout. So the fact that the Rockets now have two spinners you can depend on and Luke Wood and Sam Cook bowling well is probably the best situation they could have hoped for.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, Cook is he's an interesting bowler. I mean, you feel like he should go well in T20s. He often does, because obviously he has those real red ball skills with the new ball, and then does actually have a very good record towards the back end of the innings with that kind of, you know, the slower ball and the kind of seam up one. He's not someone you want leading your attack, or potentially you can see he's got a bad day in him, certainly, because if you pick the slower ball, there's not much else there to get him out of jail. He's not going to bowl bouncer because he's probably bowling about 78 miles an hour and not really a Yorker there, I don't think, that I've seen. But I think as someone who's kind of coming in as your, you know, your second or third seamer really in this side, to do a job, you could certainly have a lot worse. And like you say, he's been helped by the ball moving a bit, and these white balls now seem to move a lot more. It brings these kind of these kind of maybe less quick bowlers into it a bit more.
I completely agree. And I think Sam Cook's a very good example of a role player in the 100. I think not every player has to be the best standout player in your side. And you don't have to look for an incredible player who's going to be one of the dominant players in the tournament. You don't have to be like, well, this guy's got huge upside, let's bring him in. Sometimes you can just have a nice player who fulfills a role. Sam Cook can bowl up top. He has some slow balls. He can be useful where you need him. He's not a leader of the attack, but he can play nicely. And a role player like that playing well for the Rockets is really huge. They beat the Spirit the other night, the Rockets, now 5-1. We'll move on from them very quickly now, but before we do you think they're the favourites for the tournament at this point?
Yeah, I definitely think they are. I mean, they just have the informed players at the moment. I mean, the biggest worry for me personally before the tournament was simply that they are not going to score enough runs, because they're just not going to try to score enough runs, essentially. And that with that lack of 20 extra balls from a T20 match, that's basically 20, or I guess if he plays half of them, 10 balls Milan doesn't get at the end to score another 30 runs. But with Milan sort of going off so quickly, and Munro and Hales in form, like you say, the bowling's been pretty good all round. I think they're definitely the favourites at the moment, top of the table, and look pretty balanced.
I'd agree. I think also Colin Munro, another good example of a role player for them, aggressive, gets after the spin. He's been very key for them as well. Let's move on to the London Spirit, shall we? Obviously lost to the Rockets last night, now 4-1 after 5 games. I don't think they're a side that we necessarily thought would be front runners. We certainly didn't think they'd be as bad as last year. We thought they'd be a mid-table side, but they played really nicely throughout. Owen Morgan's played quite well. Adam Rossington's really flashed, obviously, in that one innings. And then with the ball, Nathan Ellis, Liam Dawson, Jordan Thompson even have done enough to win them games. So I think they've been probably better than we thought they would be. Ultimately, though, there's going to be games that are going to be closer for them. Maybe the batting doesn't fire. And I think that's why a player that's going to be really key for them is Nathan Ellis. You've got two spinners in Dawson Crane who are good. But in those death overs, in those close games, Nathan Ellis is going to be that guy you're going to be depending on.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, he's been really good this summer, both in the Blast of Hampshire and obviously in 100 here. I've massive first boy summer massively seen a lot of him. I mean, he was obviously got picked up in the IPL, but then it was kind of a mixed blessing in terms of working out how good he was, because one case picked up in the IPL, that's good. But on the flip side, even when Punjab were just like absolutely hemorrhaging runs at the end, they weren't really playing him. So you may sort of wonder whether how good is this guy. But yeah, he seems to have a really good plan. He's got decent pace, good slow ball, you know, good dual career. He's not someone you feel like it's gonna, you know, he's not like Bumrah can come in at the death and just blow you away, but he looks like he knows what he's doing and he can perform the skills he has well. And at the right time. And it's, yeah, you say it's very key, because their other death bowler is ostensibly seems to be Thompson, who very good player, but you're not, he's not really a dependable death bowler, you would say, over a long period of time. And I think a side can get away with one, you know, with one kind of end being filled in at the death. But once you, if you had two, you had someone who wasn't as good as Ellis and Thompson, then you can, yeah, the number of runs you can concede to the death is almost unlimited on a given day.
I think that's the thing with Thompson. Ultimately, he's not dependable at the death. He can do a job. He can take wickets. He's been good so far this tournament. There will be days that he leaks runs, though, and that's where Ellis comes into it. And I remember him coming through for the Hurricanes in the Big Bash. And originally, he's kind of a Yorker merchant. He'd come in and bowl some pretty poor kind of low full tosses that were taking wickets, and sometimes he could get him away. Now he has all these slow balls, these variations. He comes in with a plan. I think that's key in this modern era of T20 where batters are so good. You have to have a plan. You have to stick to it. He has a plan. He sticks to it. It works. I think my other question for them really is, you know, you can have Ellis on one end. He's bowled very well. You've got to have the other guy at the other end also perform. We saw Chris Wood, very expensive in that first game. Jordan Thompson, again, not necessarily a dependable death bowler. Why do you think they're a bit reluctant to give Brad Wheel a go over Thompson and Chris Wood in those key overs? Because he was great last year in the 100.
Yeah, I don't really know. I mean, Thompson's been expensive. Thompson's always been expensive and wicket-taking his career with the ball. And I was surprised when they went with him at all, really, the summer of the death. Chris Wood's, yeah, a decent bowler, but not really someone I'd go for. But Wheel, yeah, he's a very good death bowler. I mean, he's someone... I remember when I was profiling sort of Hampshire for the Blast, one of the biggest strengths I had for them was death bowling, because they had, well, Ellis, but also Will in their team. And to be honest, with all the, you know, with all the injuries England have, if he was English, he might be in the England side almost. So it seems for that death row, so it seems very odd. I'm not really sure what they're not seeing in Will that kind of I think everybody else is seeing.
Yeah.
I don't really know. It's not like they've got a bowling attack so full of unbelievably gun players that you just can't get him in or give him a go. It just seems quite bizarre to me, to be honest.
Yeah, I agree. I think ultimately with the spirit side, there's going to come a point where they're not going to have a special things from Rossington. Things aren't going to go their way. They're going to have to back their key players. With the ball, it's going to be Ellis, Wheel, the likes of that. So I think that's ultimately where their tournament's going to come down to. So I think Ellis is going to be key for that. Let's move on to the Oval Invincibles, who are one of those teams who are kind of this 3-2, 2-3 area, very bunch in the mid-table, who are going to have to come clutch for the last couple of games, win two, maybe three to get into the finals. I think the player that's going to be key for them is the guy who's going to be replacing their key player. Sonal Narine's been fantastic this tournament, gone a runner ball exactly in five games so far, whilst taking 9 wickets and an average of 11. He has been a complete gun for them, so I just can't get him away. And we saw that in the IPL. He won the lesser runner ball throughout the IPL, which is incredible. He's done it again in the 100. He's now off to the CPL. They're bringing in a guy called Peter Hadsoglu. He's a player that I don't think everybody will know, Jack. You're very fond of him, obviously done well in the Big Bash for the Renegades and now the Scorchers. Tell us a little bit about Hadsoglu for the people who don't know.
Yeah, so Hadsoglu is an interesting bowler. He's a leg spinner, but he's a very unusual one, essentially. He's extremely tall. He bowls from past the perpendicular, which basically means that his right arm essentially goes above his left ear when he delivers it. And he basically has two balls. He has the one that angles into the right-hander, hits the seam, and because he's very tall, it just sort of holds, and you see a lot of skied, caught sort of square leg, fine leg, mid-wicket, etc., off slogs. And he has the one that basically misses the seam, hits the leather and skids through and kind of whacks you on the ankles and gets your LB, essentially. And it's quite an effective little package, because the end result of what are basically the same ball in terms of where it ends up is very, very different in terms of height and of in relation to you on the crease there. The one issue he has to do is that he's a far, far better bowler versus right-handers and left-handers by a very considerable margin. And I think this could come back to sort of haunt him a little bit, because for me at least, the biggest game left in the season is over versus Phoenix on Tuesday. For me, whoever wins that game is probably very likely to qualify in that sort of third place spot, or to at least get through. And in a side that has Moeen Ali, who will come in 3 or 4, and Hatsiglou, who will only bowl in the middle overs, it seems like it's a bit of a strange choice knowing that. I don't know what you think about it.
I think it's a bad matchup, specifically against left-handers. Hatsiglou is an interesting one for me. I mean, in terms of how he went on the bash, 15 games, 15 wickets, averaging 25, a corner at 7.26. Very good. I think it should be mentioned that big pash players are allergic to anything that looks like leg spin, even though it probably isn't leg spin. But I think my question with Hatsiglou really is ultimately how he goes against really good players of spin. Moeen Ali will murder balls turning into him that he just doesn't rate. I think that's going to be an issue for the Invincibles in that matchup. In fact, I wonder if they actually don't play him and they go in and play Rousseau and Cartwright and Hasnain as their overseas for that game and don't necessarily play the leg spinner purely because of the matchup. I think that would be sensible. Maybe play an extra seamer in Milnes. Briggs has the same issue, but whatever you want to go with, I think that might be their play. But I agree. What's interesting me about Hatsiglou is, for me, he looks like the kind of bowler who should be a power play operator and then bowl some in the middle overs. I know that's not necessarily what he always does. My ultimate question about him, though, is as much as I like him, I'm not really sure he's anything more than a good domestic big bash player. I think a lot of the times you're always thinking, well, can he do it in other leagues? Some players just can't, and that's fine. Well, that's absolutely fine. Some players are good in their leagues, and that's great. I worry if that's ultimately Hatsoglu's issue when he doesn't really turn it and left-handers are going to get after him. You feel like if Moeen and Livingstone are at the crease, do you really want to bowl them at all? And that's not a great situation for your overseas to be in.
No, I totally agree. I definitely agree with your point on sort of power play bowling, but he feels like a sort of guy that if he could get a ball with the Lancaster ones, get it through, be really effective. I mean, he was used weirdly at the Scorchers this season. They basically used him as a bit more Ashton Agar. Like when they run out of Ashton Agar, they just sort of bowled hats at them, like, can you be Ashton Agar, please? But yeah, I think it's a bit of a strange position they put themselves in because that game is important. I mean, like you say, you can play Hasnain, but he's been going all around the park this 100. So that's not ideal. I think if I was them, perhaps I would have picked up someone like a Zahir Khan just for that particular game, turn it away from Mo. He's a very decent bowler versus right-handers, but just specifically for that Phoenix game, I think that would be a more sensible option. Despite that, I do like Hatsiglou, just for the very particular situation, that situation they are actually in this tournament.
Yeah, I kind of agree on that point. And it's difficult for them because none of their bowlers have been particularly great other than Narayan. Currans have been expensive in general. Tom Curran specifically is not really taking any wickets. Rhys Topley's been expensive. Mohammad Hasnain hasn't really got into his work as well as you'd like. I love Mohammad Hasnain, but he's not had a great tournament. I think the fact they're not using him with a new ball is probably the ultimate issue there, because I think what you saw in the Big Bash is that he does swing it. But obviously, when you have Topley and Sam Curran, you're not going to bowl him with a new ball, which is where that issue comes into. I think that's kind of the Big Bash thing, isn't it? I think it's quite interesting that Mohammad Hasnain, this really quick bowler, does so well in the Big Bash and it looks like nobody can play him. And then he comes over to England where you think, well, maybe not everyone's as attuned to the quick bowling and he goes the distance. He's going to be good. I think he can develop. But I think it's an interesting point about the quality of the Big Bash compared to the 100. I think that's probably something that relates to Peter Hatsiglou as well. We'll see how they go. But I think ultimately, the Oval Invincibles have to be clever about how they use their resources. I think we're going to see interchangeable overseas. I think we'll see points where we see both Cartwright and Rousseau come in. I think we'll see times that they'll play Hatsiglou. They're just going to have to play their cards correctly. And I back Tom Moody and the team in general to do that. I do have questions about them. We'll see how they go, though. We'll see how they go, because if Paul Jacks can get going, if Jason Roy ever finds form, they could be a really, really good side. Also worth mentioning, Riley Rousseau's not had a great tournament yet. Only scored 24 runs in 3 games. So it would be nice to see him get going as well. And that might unlock a new thing for them, given how good he's been this year. Let's move on to the Birmingham Phoenix, who are the other 3-2 side. There are lots of questions about the Phoenix coming into this tournament, Jack. Theoretically, mostly about their bowling, because you have Moeen, you have Liam Livingstone, you have Will Smead, all these excellent batters. But with all the injuries to the bowling department, we really weren't sure how they were going to go. And there are a lot of problem areas still, but the real shining light for them has been Benny Howell, who has been utterly, utterly phenomenal for them.
Yeah, he's been absolutely exceptional. I mean, Economy kind of under, you know, 7 runs per over in old money, and, you know, five wickets, an average of about 22. He's been very, very good, especially in a bowling attack where, you know, you always like to go for a lot of runs when you play for Phoenix, because one, the bowls around you are probably going for runs, so there's a lack of pressure being built, and two, because your top four are so stupidly explosive that teams will start to attack you a lot more because they know they're going to need to, or because they're chasing a big score. But yeah, he's just been so good. I mean, he's such a good operator. He has his, you know, all his variations. He just hits a good length. Left-handers, right-handers, doesn't really seem to matter. And just, you know, just gets through those overs through the middle, and you kind of can't really see how you're ever going to score it, you know, take him for 2 runs a ball, even on a bad day, really, because he seems to have so many different options and so much accuracy that even if he just hits for, like, the other night, hit for a big six and stuff, like, it's not like the wheels come off. He just seems to go back and just hit his spot again.
Yeah, and I think it's a good point about players coming hard against you, because the economy rates are high for the Phoenix, but the strike rates in terms of wicket are very good. So Benny Howell, strike rate of 19, Kane Richardson, strike rate of 10, Moeen Ali, strike rate of 11.2, Henry Brooks, strike rate of 12, Tom Howell, strike rate of 11.7. So that's a wicket every however many balls in that instance. It shows that teams are coming hard, and that means you're taking wickets, but you are more expensive. And that's why Benny's been so good. Teams just can't seem to get him away, and that's really important for a Phoenix side that ultimately have issues with the ball, because they're not depending on Adam Milne, who had one of the best T20 tournaments ever last year. You're not depending on the guys they brought in, like Ollie Stone. You're depending on Kane Richardson, who's a good bowler, and then the likes of Tom Helm and Henry Brooks. So I think the form of Benny Howell's very important. He's got all those slow balls, his class. I think what's kind of troubling them ultimately for them is, whilst Benny Howell is a gun and he's coming through, the other guy that you'd theoretically think would be a gun for them, Imran Tahir, has not been good yet this tournament. Played 5 games, averaging 54, only taken 2 wickets, been expensive. When you have a bowling attack that's pretty injured in general, you don't have your best guys out there, you need your gun leg spinner to come good. Tahir hasn't. I wonder if maybe he's just gone slightly over that hill now, and it's costing the Phoenix, because if he could come good for them, it'd be absolutely massive, but he just isn't bowling as well as we've seen him do over the past few years.
Yeah, it's been a strange one. He's not been particularly great, and he obviously numerically his numbers, but even to watch, he hasn't looked like he's had much fizz in his bowling, really, which is something you sort of associate with him. Yeah, it's hard because obviously he's incredibly old, but he's still been pretty good to quite recently. So, I mean, possibly we are seeing just like that moment of going over the hill of sort of age rate decline. And, you know, fair, bowlers often do seem to not be old until like one day they just kind of are. You know, it's not necessarily a smooth curve or anything. It could also just be 5 games, just having 5 bad games. But yeah, it hasn't looked very encouraging. It's not like, it's not like someone like, for instance, someone like Lintott hasn't had a great tournament, but actually just watching him bowl, he looks the same as his bowling in the Blast. He's just been hit by some good players and, you know, hasn't had his best days. Whereas Tahir doesn't look the Tahir you associate with, you know, at CSK running through people, etc. So that's definitely a worry for him.
Yeah, he's 43. So it's going to come at some point. But what I would say, he hasn't played much cricket recently. He hasn't played much like high standard cricket. And ultimately with a leg spinner, and it's always the tell with a quality leg spinner, is their energy through the crease. It's where everything comes from. It's like with Matt Parkinson earlier this summer, he didn't have much energy through the crease. He was kind of meandering up and wasn't really forcing himself through his action, getting through his action. Because ultimately your action is where all the revs come from. It's where the pace comes from. It's where all the energy in your bowling comes from. Everything comes through what you drive through the crease with. And I think many people have this kind of perception of leg spin of, well, the Shane Warne type, who kind of wandered up to the crease and threw his shoulder over. That's because Shane Warne has got some of the strongest shoulders of all time. The man was a freak physically. No one will think about that because he looked a little bit tubby and he didn't look like that huge athlete, but his shoulders were incredible. No other leg spinner has that. And so ultimately, where these more modern leg spinners who don't turn it as much necessarily and sometimes bowl a little bit quicker or whatever, or everything they do comes through their action and the energy through their action. It's why a bowler like Mitch Swepson maybe sometimes struggles, because he tries to bowl like Shane Warne and actually he's not got the frame for it. And it's the same thing for Tahir. He's not getting through his action. He's wandering up to the crease. He's not driving through his action. The energy isn't there. And so he's not the same bowler. That's where ultimately it comes to a problem for them. So I think that is an issue area. So I think it's a concern. The Phoenix, I know, are a side that we both really enjoy. I thought they would really struggle this year without the bowlers, but they're 3-2. They're in the thick of it. And I think what's great is when you lose Wokes, you lose Stone, you lose Milne, you lose all of these bowlers you're depending on. The fact that you're still in it, I think, speaks a lot about the culture they've built, the squad they've built, and the job that Dan Vettori's been doing.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, when when they lost those bowlers, you felt like it was going to be a real struggle for them. I mean, with any respect to kind of Helm and Brooks, et cetera, if you offered me, you know, Helm or Ollie Stone, it's like you wouldn't even give it a moment's thought. And I think they've been quite clever, to be honest. Like, they've used those two seamers, Brooks and Helm, who are essentially attacking weapons, as attacking weapons. They've kind of made peace with the fact that they will go for runs, but there's probably not a world in which you can hide their overs. So they've sort of said to them clearly, you know, try and bowl wicket-taking balls, bowl aggressively. I mean, I saw Brooks bowl at Birmingham in the summer with that fifer, and you know, it wasn't for the great Saturday or anything, but he was just running it, tearing in, bowling quickly, and you know, he deserved to have a fortunate day because he was having a go at it, essentially. So I think, yeah, they've done better than I think me and probably you thought they could do, really.
Yeah, it's been impressive. They might not get there, but they have a chance, and that's a lot to say in a high quality competition. Moving down into the rest of this tournament, we're going to the teams that are 2-3 now, starting with the Manchester Originals, who went 0-3 the first three games. I think we thought that maybe we'd pinned them correctly. I still think we have pinned them correctly, but they've come back impressively the last couple of games, obviously beating Welsh Fire, no big whoop there, but then doing a really good job on the Birmingham Phoenix the other night. They have quality. They're losing Dre Russ now, but they still have Butler, they still have Salt, they still have Madsen, they still have Paul Walter, I guess, who'd suddenly they've gone all-rounder. This side still has a chance. And I think after the first three games, that's quite impressive. The key player that I would quite like to focus on is, I mean, Richard Gleeson's probably in this conversation if he can come back. We don't know when he's coming back or if he'll come back. But the bowler, I think, if he doesn't come back, is really Mitch Stanley, who has bowled absolute heat in the games he's played. I think he didn't have a particularly great blast in terms of numbers for Worcestershire this year, but we were hearing from guys on the circuit that this guy is breaking the speed gun. He was bowling properly quick and he was swinging it. And I think what we've seen in these first two games is that, you know, if you look at the economy, he's only taken one wicket. He's not looked hugely impressive numbers-wise, but the heat he is bowling with and the tone he is setting at the top of the innings for the Originals, which really struggled with that early on, is crucial. So what have you made of him? I mean, there's lots to be excited about.
Yeah, he's a very exciting bowler. I mean, I've seen a bit of him bowl, not a huge amount. It's one of those hard ones, isn't it, where you kind of want to get really, really excited about it, but then, like you say, the numbers haven't been that amazing. I mean, I think he does suit Manchester because they do need a bit of threat with the fast bowling. I mean, the spin bowling is fine. That's all good, but you feel like they do need to have that ability to take wickets, say, in a power play, to actually let those spins exert pressure. And you almost wouldn't mind someone that will occasionally go for runs if they're going to give you a chance to basically win a game, essentially. Mm. So I think, yeah, he's looked pretty good. I mean, I think ideally you wouldn't have him, you wouldn't be so dependent on him at the stand of a tournament. He's someone, you know, a better organised squad, you'd have him. And then in there, and then maybe one day there's an injury or you think it's a good pitch for him and you roll him out and just say, bowl 90 miles an hour. But yeah, I'd be interested to see how he goes. I can see him almost winning a game, then losing a game before the end of the tournament for them.
I think that's the thing. They have to be clever with how they use him. I don't think you can use him at the back end necessarily. I don't think you really want to be using him too often. I think they bowled him an over too many the other night, actually. I think you want to give him two overs up top and maybe an over in the middle. Let him set the tone, let him bowl quick, let him steam in. What he can offer you is, I think, a huge upgrade on what they had in Fred Clarkson. Ultimately, the issue is now that Sean Abbott, who really struggled the first three games, who then came better in the last couple of games, is now gone. You're going to potentially depending on Josh Little now. I think when you have Little, Stanley, Parkinson, Hartley, and then I guess a bit of Paul Walter, Tristan Stubbs, and Ashton Turner, that's where you're going to run into issues. So I think it's important that whoever they roll out as the seamers, specifically Stanley, who has the wheels to do it, really performs. because they're going to need it, because Salt and Butler, you know, come into their own a little bit now. But without Russell, they're really going to need these bowlers to step up to have a chance.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it isn't the best seam bowling attack. That's quite obvious. And Josh Little is not a bad bowler. He just is very in and out. And I think Ireland use him weirdly. Sometimes he's opening the bowl and trying to swing it. Sometimes he's an enforcer. I think maybe they do that just because he's quite mouthy and always acts like one. And then sometimes he's a death bowler, so it's been hard to really tell how he should be used. But Stanley and Little is a sort of bowling, you know, the seam bowling attack that you can see knocking a team over or just looking pretty the next dot ball is going to come from necessarily. I think you're right saying that Stanley needs to be used cleverly. I think at the moment what he has is pace, and it's pretty much just pace. So you wouldn't want to bowl him to say, you know, a sort of bat that isn't really bothered by extreme pace, because then I think he just becomes a pretty normal seamer. You want to be chucking him on against people, maybe spin hitters, etc., who just that in itself bothers them essentially.
Yeah, I think you want to bowl an over or two up top where he can swing it and bowl really quick and then find that much up in the middle overs. I find Josh Little quite interesting, because you're right. I do think there's this perception of him as an enforcer just because he likes to have a chat. He reminds me a bit of like slightly early career Ben Rain, who acted like he was 10 miles an hour quicker than he was for Leicestershire, steaming in at 82 and screaming at the batter like he just delivered a 90 mile an hour bouncer. I'm not ultimately sure what Josh Little's going to provide. I think he's a nice player, but I think you're right. It could be a case of where are the dot balls going to come from. So I think they might struggle, especially when you lose Russell from the equation. So we'll see. They still have Butler, they still have Salt, they still have Parkinson. They still have a chance. But I think that ultimately the performance of their seamers not standing is going to be utterly key. The Northern Superchargers, also 2-3. I think another side that we kind of see, like the originals, kind of as a mid-table, bottom half of the table team. They've really been, I think, quite dependent on Adam Live batting really nicely for them to have opportunities. Adam Live specifically has been fantastic this tournament. He's faced 92 balls, and I think 27 of them have gone to the boundary. Strike rate of 200, averaging 37. He has played really, really well for them. I think when you look at what they have on the rest of the lineup, Harry Brook isn't playing too often. David Willey hasn't really fired with the bat. He's going to be really, really key to their chances.
Definitely, yeah. He's been absolutely exceptional. I mean, he struggled last year, didn't he, in the 100. But as you pointed out here loads of times, that he was absolutely screwed over with the matchups by Anthony Magdalene. He's always been hyper-aggressive in the blast. I feel like the plan for the Superchargers this year was, you know, Live goes off the train, Faf goes at 135 and then explodes at the end. The problem is that Faf hasn't really got in at any point. So it kind of, then you're getting through to the more power hitters, and they're still, they're not really getting to their hitters when they should be, essentially.
Yeah, I think that's the issue. I think it's just how this team works. And it was worse last year, as you said, with the Bold Brothers partnership, where Lynn was just so poor against spin and Blythe isn't great against it either. You could really just bowl it to him up top and there wasn't much options. Now, you can't really bowl spin up top to them as much with Faf up there, and you could throw David Willey up there, and they have Michael Pepper up there as well, who's a decent player of spin. Much more difficult, and now Live is thriving because the seam's on, he can go at it. I think the problem with this side is balance. We've seen the fact that they don't really have a depth to their batting lineup. They really wanted to be playing David Visa as a third overseas player so they can have him bat seven and bowl, but that's not really ideal. And suddenly you're seeing them play Roloff van der Merwe at seven or eight just because they need the batting depth, or as a bowler, he's been going the distance. Where you actually have Callum Parkinson there, who's a significantly better left-arm spinner who bowls really well in the power play. They don't feel like they can play him because they don't have the depth batting-wise. It just feels like they haven't quite worked out how to play this yet. And which probably isn't helped by the fact that a lot of their bowlers, for example, Rain, van der Merwe, Visa, Miles, that they've tried, have been going the distance. Potts as well in the two games he played. So it's a balance issue. And when that balance doesn't work, you're going to need Adam Live to fire and put together big innings and get off to quick starts to give you a good chance.
Yeah, definitely. Like you said, they have been struggling with the balance a lot as a team. Van der Merwe, I think, is a bit of a he's a bit of a facade as a kind of batting depth option.
Yeah.
Because he can hit the ball, but from my memory of him anyway, it's like you'll see him county summer, he'll play basically as a bowler, and then like twice he'll hit 37 or 7 or something. And you think, Jesus Christ, where's that come from? And he kind of just angers it over the boundary. But he's not someone that in a short tournament you'd even, you know, he's not even a 1 in 8 coming off batter, really. I mean, almost, you know, you say Parkinson's a far better bowler, exceptional against right-handers generally. You'd almost think they'd be better off with him also just from a batting point of view, because worst comes to worst with Parkinson, like he'll face 10 balls and everyone else can just slog what they want to ahead of him. Whereas at the moment, it feels like either they could be getting to a point where they're wasting a bowling slot because their batters have come off, or all the batters collapse, and then you've got Van der Merwe coming in to kind of salvage it. All he wants to do is hit a six. So he either doesn't get used, or he's coming in a situation that isn't really right for him. So I don't really see why you'd ever choose Van der Merwe over Parkinson, especially in this particular side.
I think it's ultimately a false depth issue, isn't it? That's ultimately what it is. You feel like you need to bat deep. You feel like you need to add something there. But ultimately, the difference between Callum Parkinson and roll off with the ball is so stark, and the opportunity that Callum Parkinson would offer as a significantly better power play bowler is so much more of a bigger impact than what you get with roll off the bat. I think that's their kind of issue this year. And obviously with Wahab Riaz being ruled out, Dwayne Bravo leaving the tournament now, there's a lot of questions about how they're going to go about making this whole thing work. So we'll see how they go. I'm not completely convinced that they're able to make this work when, other than live, no one's really dominated with the bat, and with the ball, David Willey and Al Rashid are really carrying things. So we'll see how they go. I think we're going to go very quickly through the two teams that are effectively eliminated in the Brave and the Fire. Starting with the Brave, I think they've really been hurt by injuries. Tamer Mills is out. Jofra Archer's out. Chris Jordan's out. Craig Overton's out. George Garton is still struggling with long COVID. Your five best seam bowlers are all injured or really struggling, and they haven't been able to pivot out of that, because out of their spinners, Rayhan, Linter and Moriarty are all good operators. None of them really bowl in the power play. So there wasn't that room to really pivot. And when you're bowling Hogan and Stoinis up front, just hasn't worked. So very difficult season for them, really. And ultimately, there was nowhere to turn, I don't think.
Yeah, I totally agree. It's been really hard from those injuries, like you say. I mean, they were a very seam-reliant team last year. They've also probably been hurt by, like, to say, like, George Garton's not actual injury, but he is injured in that they can, with the other injuries, there's a temptation to play him, even though he clearly isn't really match fit because he's been so, you know, horrendously ill for so long with long COVID. And ultimately, like you say, you can't really get, if your three best seamers are out, you would have been stupid to have got three more really good options in the draft because you're just wasting money. And then you end up with Michael Hogan, who's a perfectly good bowler, but bowling to Andre Russell off the back of one good blast season. And like, nothing about taking a load of wickets in the Sheffield Shield every year for like 25 years kind of prepares you for Andre Russell in form just absolutely range hitting you. And there's not much you can do about that. I mean, it's not like Hogan or Stoinis really are bowling badly. They're just bowling like themselves, which is kind of a bit of an issue for them. And like you say, the spinners haven't been amazing, haven't been terrible. It's just like you can get lucky or unlucky with a wrist spinner having a great season or just having a pretty average one. But yeah, it has been an issue for them. I mean, probably their best bowler has been maybe James Fuller, which is
very weird, which is an incredibly weird situation to end up in. But I think that's the issue. When you lose all those seamers, there's nowhere to go, because you have to front load Stoinis and you have to front load Hogan, because again, none of those spinners really bowl on the power play. Moriarty, sorry, I've tried him there. It's not really where he bowls, because he's probably 2 or 3 miles an hour too slow to bowl there. I think the only option they really could have gone to is brought in a player like Mark Watt as a replacement domestically and been trying to be more flexible, pack your side with spin, play the two leggies, play Watt and just try and rotate that way. But it's just very, very difficult to do. And ultimately, they probably needed a batter to start dominating the tournament to make this work. And none of them have. So it was always going to be very difficult. I mean, when Stoinis is averaging 15 at a strike of 111. Tim David, again, not really done much this tournament. Quinton de Kock, not done much this tournament. the bowlers aren't there. There's nowhere to go. So a rough season for Mahela, but don't think it's necessarily an indication of this franchise. I just think when you have all those injuries, it's going to be very, very difficult.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's been very unlucky. I think when hindsight is 2020, isn't it? But 100. I think on reflection, they'll be annoyed with themselves for perhaps not just calling George Galton injured for the tournament and replacing him beforehand and giving him a hug. He's this weird situation of just being an injured player who can actually play, essentially. And if they could replace him early on, got another seamer in, when three seamers basically go down in the tournament, you're picking three options from a very limited player pool. And you're just never really going to be able to get across it, essentially.
I think the only players that are left in terms of replacement seamers at this point, what is it, like Scott Curry, Zach Chappell? You just don't really have the... don't really have the horses at that point, unfortunately. So it's difficult, isn't it? The Welsh Fire, we've talked about them enough, really, haven't we? It's just another tough season. We thought it would be very difficult to really go anywhere from what it was last year. They were just so poor, and I thought the rebuild was fine. But ultimately, the key players for them were the two players to pick for 125k. And Tom Banton and Joe Clark. Tom Banton's averaging 17 at a strike of 106. Joe Clark's averaging a 12 with a strike of 102. There's nowhere to go at that point, really, is there? I mean, the only player in any real sort of form is Ben Duckett, who's averaging 24 at a strike of 136. I mean, there was just nowhere for them to go. And it's been another very, very poor season. And I almost wonder, as harsh as it seems, if they'll keep Gary Kirsten around for a third season, given this is even worse than last year.
Yeah, they've really, really struggled with the bat, haven't they? I mean, Banton always feels like he's a great player in there, but like after a certain number of, once you've gone 5-6 tournaments without really doing an awful lot, it's like how much you're just kidding yourself about someone's ability, essentially. And like you say, it was taking a lot of money in the draft. Yeah, Clark also been very bad. Yeah, as a whole, it's just been a real, real battle for them, hasn't it? I mean, look down their numbers now, and just like no one's getting runs. The highest score anyone's got from this season is 44 from Banton, and that's out of 68 runs that he scored. So, the bowling's actually been bad, although that might be massaged by the fact that if a team is collapsing the whole time, you just kind of like go for a stroll in the park during the chase, don't you? But yeah, it's just... I mean, probably unlucky to an extent. I mean, David Miller's gone from the team of the tournament in the IPL to can't get off the square, and that is just unlucky because players fluctuate in form and sometimes you catch them just after their hot streak. But it's definitely a side with significant issues in there, isn't it? And I don't really see how they solve them apart from just hoping that Tom Banton goes back to being Tom Banton when he was 20.
They were never going to be a good side of the tour. I never thought they were a side that really, really going to be up there. But when Sam Hain is a really good blast, doesn't fire. Joe Clark and Tom Banton, 125k players, don't fire. David Miller, who's great in the RPL, doesn't fire. There's nowhere to turn. But ultimately, there's just nowhere to turn for them. So I do feel bad for them, because I think there could have been a version of this side that could have done all right. And I do think that this was ultimately probably going to be a two-year rebuild. So I think they need to have patience in terms of rebuilding it. I just don't know. Oh, and this is the great thing about the 100. I've absolutely no idea who would fire a coach. This is an interesting like little debate here, isn't it? Like, who would make that decision? Because we've seen a coach leave in Darren Layman, who left for personal reasons. We know who appoints the coaches. Who fires the coach? I guess it's the general manager of the franchise. Each franchise has one, but I don't know how that works. It's very interesting, actually.
Yeah, these tournaments that are like franchised but essentially all owned by the board anyway are quite odd. I mean, I know you've pointed out here before, like kind of the the way they used to be are probably basically forced transfers in the women's tournament.
Yeah.
to make it more reputable because they forgot to have a draft. But yeah, it is a weird one. I mean, I'm not really sure. It's the complete extreme opposite to the IPL, isn't it? Where like the owners of the team are like very much too involved perhaps in the running of the team. And in the 100, it's weird because there isn't an owner for the team. There isn't really anyone you can identify being with, like they are running this team. They hire the analyst, they hire the coach. It sort of feels like they all just sort of drop in. I don't really know. I mean, who's, for instance, like, who is hiring the analysts for each franchise? Is that just the coach hiring them? I have no idea.
It's interesting, and that's another side of things, because we've seen analysts come into and leave teams. I think actually half the teams changed analyst over the off-season. And I think that's another thing where Welsh Fire come into. Ben Jones of Crickviz is now there, who I think deserves a shot at rebuilding this team. So I actually thought the off-season they did was probably the best they could do in the draft. And I think we gave them credit at the time, and I think they deserve credit for that. It's just nobody's fired, and that's very difficult. But then I guess it gets into, we can build a squad, but what's the culture like? So, interesting. I'm going to try and find out for that. I'd quite like to know who makes those decisions, and I wonder if anyone will make that decision. I guess we'll find out in the off-season, but before we get on to the fun of coach firings and hirings and any of those things that may or may not happen, I'm going to push you on this, Jack, because we always appreciate your opinion. Give me the three teams that you think are in the strongest position to qualify. I think let's just assume that the Trent Rockets are one and then they're going to get there. Who are the other two teams that you fancy?
So I think it's going to be London Spirit and Birmingham Phoenix going through. I don't have much confidence in Spirit doing well once they get through, but I think that just the structural position they're in is so strong. I basically see it really as an Oval Phoenix shootout on Tuesday to go through. And I just think that with all we discussed, the lack of Narayan, I just think that Birmingham look well placed to win that, despite the fact they're not at home. But I think it's going to be a shootout there, and Birmingham will win that game and join Spirit and Rockets in the final three.
I think it's the issue, isn't it? Because Manchester Originals, if they won all their final three games, only get to 10 points. Trent Rockets already at 10 points. London Spirit only need one win to get to 10 points. And then Invincibles and Phoenix, whoever wins that game against each other, would only need one win out of the final two to get to 10 points. So whilst the Originals and technically, I guess, the Superchargers are in with a shot, it feels like it would be difficult for them. I'd agree. I'm going to put my horses behind the Invincibles against the Phoenix personally. I think that there will be a point where their bowlers start to fire and their batters start to fire. And I think at some point, you'd hope that Jason Roy will catch fire. You'd hope Riley Rousseau finds form. You'd hope that the bowlers start bowling better than they have. And I think it's possible. And I think also it's worth remembering that maybe at times the Phoenix don't always match up as well against left arm seam like Topley. Specifically, Smead doesn't match up brilliantly against it. So I agree. I think that shootout's going to be crucial. Could go either way, and that's what's great about this tournament. I think it's very nicely placed that we still have all these teams in it and we still have lots of intrigue. So excited to see how it goes. Jack, thank you so much for this, mate. We always love having your insight. Where can people find more of your stuff?
Yeah, so you can find me on Twitter at cricket_pig. I've got a sort of blog attached to that with a reasonable number of articles on there now, and can have a, hopefully next week, a sort of big article on left arm wrist spin coming out. Watch out for that if you're interested.
All the best, mate. Thank you very much for coming on, and thank you very much for listening. If you want to find out more about what we do, it's at Podcast100 on Twitter. Loads of content going on through the season, so check out our feed and check out our Twitter page. But for now, thank you very much for listening, and we'll speak to you next time.